Voice of Reason Broadcast Network presents The Heretics Hour with Carolyn Yeager. Carolyn Yeager brings you news and commentary on Holocaust revisionism, World War II history, free speech issues, and more. And now, here's Carolyn.
Good evening, ladies and gentlemen. I'm happy to bring you the February 27th, 2012 installment of Heretics Hour, coming to you live from Voice of Reason Network. I'll be with you the next 2 hours. My guest tonight is someone you know very well, Rodney Martin, this being his 7th appearance on this program, always to do with culture, both political and artistic, of the Third Reich. Our topic tonight is the high achievement in the fields of science and technology, medicine and health. There is so much to say about it that I don't know if we'll be able to fit it all in. But just to give you an idea, there is a book titled Das Erbe Hitlers, which is translated something like Hitler's Heritage, that lists over 100 inventions from the Third Reich years that are still in use in Germany today, and in many cases all over the world. For example, corporation law, marriage law, patent law, color photography, the picture phone, telex, mini camera, mass tourism, the helicopter, rockets, jet airplane, the Olympic torch run. Yes, the first time that was done was at the 1936 for the 1936 Berlin Olympics, when the passing the torch from Greece all the way to the place that the current Olympics were going to be held was done, and it's been done ever since. Perlon, which I'll mention later, summer time, which I guess is daylight savings time, not anything that I like too much, but I guess it helps economically, wind power, and naturally the Volkswagen, people's car, not to mention the Autobahn. Well, what is Perlon? I looked that up because I didn't know. In 1938, Perlon, a synthetic fiber similar to the American nylon, was invented by the German chemist Dr. Paul Schlock at IG Farben. Nylon was invented in 1935 at the DuPont labs in the United States, and it was no doubt patented, so a country like Germany needed to come up with their own variety of synthetic fiber. But you should know that in 1927, Professor Dr. Hermann Staudinger did research on the atomic structure of wool, and that was a forerunner to the production of fully synthetic fibers. So a German was behind the whole discovery of synthetic fibers, even though the first work was done previous to the Third Reich, but not very much previous. All right, more on that later. Now I will read from The Fire, The Bombing of Germany, 1941 to 1945 by Jörg Friedrich, and this time about the Holocaust of Hamburg. I'm beginning on page 95 tonight, and we'll read directly through to page 101. I forgot to give the page numbers last week, and I've started doing that because a dear listener had told me some weeks back that once I started reading this on the air, he bought the book and was reading along with me. So I'm sorry I forgot to say last week what pages I was reading. And I also want to say that Elizabeth Carto wrote to me that this book is impossible for, I assume she meant the Barnes Review bookstore, to sell now, since Columbia University Press that published it increased the price from $40 to $80 a couple of years ago, with only a 20% discount, I guess, for the bulk purchasers. Now, it seemed that, she says, it seemed that somebody did not want to encourage sales. However, if you go to Amazon, you know, Amazon is so huge that they can do a lot anyway. They have it copies for quite a bit less than but the list price is shown as $80. I got my book a couple years ago I ordered it as a used book from Amazon, and it came in pristine condition. Just as you would, a new book would be in no better condition than what I got. And there is now also a paperback. But let me put on my reading glasses, and I'm going to get started. This is some pretty heavy-duty stuff this week. So here we go. Page 95. Didn't I say? What did I say? I said 95, yes. Okay. Churchill, Harris, and Portal first heard of a firestorm in July 1943 after Hamburg. They had spent 2 years trying to overcome the paralyzing technological and financial obstacles to annihilation from the air, and they kept morosely adding up unreal numbers of airplanes, homeless and dead. In one fell swoop, the unfathomable interaction of their weapon with the force of the elements delivered dimensions of destruction that up to then had existed only on paper. The aviation strategists perceived the forces of nature as their logical allies, and they hoped for further collaboration. A large part of Bomber Command's efforts were dedicated from then on to the Hamburgization of Berlin. That is, once they had seen what they could do and what they did in Hamburg. Berlin did not burn well. The alliance with the physics of the atmosphere was unreliable, but it became an unscheduled addition to the agenda in Kassel. I've learned that that's pronounced Kassel in October 1943. It's a town spelled K-A-S-S-E-L. It's in kind of in central Germany, sort of. Why Kassel and not Berlin? Ever since the Battle of the Ruhr, Bomber Command had been constantly experimenting with the ratio of incendiaries in the loads to be dropped. The markedly higher incendiary doses of the bombardments of Wuppertal in late May, Aachen in mid-July, and Remscheid in late July led to conflagrations extending for miles. The three raids on Hamburg in July and August also had considerably varied bomb loads. Determining the proper loads and ratios was a science of its own. The second strike of a raid used five times as many incendiaries as the first. An average of 250,000 incendiary sticks and 7,000 liquid incendiary bombs were released per square mile. Consequently, the mixture was a condition for the firestorm, as were the tinfoil strips that jammed the radar, blocking the defenses. Hamburg, too, offered laboratory conditions. The weapon unfolded as it wanted, not just as far as the defender allowed. But all the incendiaries and tinfoil strips would not have caused the massive destruction of the firestorm without the contribution of the climate. The climate was the main agent. In Forzheim, it had been bitter cold. In Hamburg, on the other hand, it was hotter and drier than it had been in 10 years. On the sweltering summer night of July 28th, the temperature was between 70 and 85 degrees Fahrenheit. Now, this is nighttime, you know, evening time, nighttime temperatures. The combination, which is pretty bad for Germany, you know, they don't have such a hot climate. The combination of the climate, the incendiary ratio, the collapsed defenses, and the structure of the city blocks created what Harris's codename Gomorrah predicted. Like Abraham in Genesis 19:28, Harris looked toward the sinful city and beheld, and lo, the smoke of the country went up as the smoke of a furnace. It melted between 40,000 and 50,000 people. 70% of them were in the Hamburg-Mitte district, where the weapon achieved a kill rate of 5.9%. In the strictly residential streets of Hammerbrook, 36% of the residents were killed. 7,000 children and adolescents lost their lives, and 10,000 were orphaned. The small, closed courtyards turned the glowing cells, whose inmates could not escape death. At the zenith of the firestorm, the pure heat radiation caused buildings to ignite all at once, from the roof to the ground, like a darting flame. The gale winds drew the oxygen out of the cellars like a gigantic pump. 6 hours of firestorm supposedly forced 2 billion tons of fresh air up more than 4 miles through the air chimney. This created horizontal wind velocities into this storm of up to 170 miles per hour, causing people to lose their footing, I guess. Trees with roots extending yards into the ground broke in half and their crowns were twisted. Poplars were bent completely horizontally. The rescue crews that later gathered the remains of those who had suffocated from the lack of oxygen or had been incinerated by the radiant heat had to let the masses of rubble cool down for 10 days. A firestorm usually developed over hours, but in Hamburg, it formed during the raid itself. The firefighters were rendered powerless because they could not move through the cratered streets and had almost no water. The storm was preceded by sunny hot weather, which had already overheated the urban area. A chimney quickly developed, and only minimal additional heating was necessary to put the immense suction of the draft into motion. This burned the horizontal storm into a torrent. Those who were caught in it were ripped into the furnace like poor souls into perdition. Neither Harris nor Bomber Command nor anyone else knew the least about the meteorological conditions. They declared the operation a success and thought they had discovered the attack that would be a reference point for future raids to emulate. The weapon had now become what they had hoped it would. Churchill's maximum use of fire had ignited within 3 years. The munitions had been uploaded in 43 minutes, and they were followed by atmospheric reactions that raged for 3 hours with the force of a Pacific hurricane. And then there was nothing left to burn. Unable to protect itself, the city consumed itself. 900,000 people fled the smoldering skeletons of buildings in which the plague of rats was the only thing left alive. A weapon that caused this kind of destruction must be a strategic one. It must decide the war. If not, then it served only for continued mass extermination. Churchill's cabinet had assured the public that it destroyed whatever served a military use, but now it welcomed the deaths of 40,000 Hamburg civilians. Let's make that 50,000 at least. Therefore, their deaths had to serve some purpose. It was believed that this massacre was best interpreted as a prelude to the Hamburgization of Berlin. A comparable attack on the capital would certainly bring an end to the regime and thus to the war. It was always under the assumption that the premise of a morale bombing applied. To the end of his days, Harris cited Hiroshima as proof of that. If the larger city of Berlin had losses of the same scale as Hamburg, then 109,000 people would have lost their lives, 1.25 times the number of Hiroshima deaths. Since after Hamburg, there were more than 340,000 additional deaths in the air war that were yet to come, half of all bombing casualties would have remained alive had there been an immediate final strike against Berlin. Would the capital have capitulated if it had experienced 3% losses? Conceivably. But the actual victims from 1943 to 1945 died without yielding any such return from the aggressor's perspective. They were killed in a slow, relentless machine that ground away day and night in all parts of the Reich. Divided among the 600 remaining days of the bombing war, the effect on morale was militarily insignificant. What does the national staying power care about the 244 people who died on January 5th, 1944 in Stettin, or the 270 on June 12th, in Gelsenkirchen? No one heard about it. The news reached Recklinghausen at most. Such losses were two-thirds of the total. The Nazi Party, like Harris, expected the collapse after slaughters like Hamburg. On August 1st, Albert Speer said to Hitler that attacks like that on 6 more cities would mean the end of the war. Field Marshal Erhard Milch, Inspector General of the Luftwaffe, thought, "We have lost the war, finally lost the war." Soldiers on the battlefield would just have to dig a hole, he said, crawl into it, and wait until the attack is over. But a hole was no protection from a firestorm. Quote, "What the home front is now suffering cannot be suffered very much longer." I guess that's from Milch. I'm not sure. But Churchill's weapon was not able to pull off 6 Hamburgs. Instead, it produced 1,000 Gelsenkirchens. Immediately after the war, the U.S. occupation forces extensively investigated the psyches of the bombing victims. They found that defeatism grew after the shock of the first attack experience. However, the accumulation of experiences tended to dull the effect. The soul did not rebel. It shriveled. Apathy and depression predominated. People felt an overwhelming need for sleep, and none at all to overthrow Hitler. If there ever were a chance to do that, then it would be in a series of Hamburg-Hiroshima strikes. The atomic bomb very much resembled the firestorm in its primary impact. They both usually killed by roasting, burning to a cinder, vaporizing. Yeah, I mean, truthfully, I did say a few weeks ago that people actually vaporized, and it's true. They just disappeared physically. Harris once said that an atom bomb was just the equivalent of a certain number of normal bombs, but only as regards the sum and not the impact. The Anglo-American weapon achieved 5-digit casualty figures within a single raid, 5 times more after Hamburg in Kassel, Darmstadt, Forsheim, Dresden, Swinemünde. The 5-digit losses, however, amount to only 1/3 of the total losses. During the next 9 months of the Battle of Berlin, Bomber Command lost the strategic clout it had attained in Hamburg and the Battle of the Ruhr. Berlin would not burn, even if 3/4 of the damages there were due to fire. Much to Churchill's and Harris's dismay, they could not make the city into Hitler's funeral pyre. There was a good deal of consternation in the Royal Air Forces as to the reason that Berlin didn't burn as well as other German cities, wrote U.S. fire protection engineer James K. McElroy, who was working with the RAF. The real reason, in my opinion, he said, was the fact that the city was honeycombed with parapeted firewalls. It lacked the inner city structure that existed in medieval fortification walls. Even the tenements had a resistant, stable courtyard structure. The statisticians in Bomber Command calculated other proportions of bombs and considered double-sized bomb loads. McElroy pored over fire insurance maps of major German cities in order to determine the relationship between failed incendiary raids and the frequency of firewalls. He said, "None of us who were in this incendiary warfare business were able, at any time, to use our judgment without some sort of statistical background. The British absolutely refused to accept Berlin's resistance to fire." And here's a little quote from that says, "Fire spread in German targets was the subject of many of the debates of the British incendiary bomb test panel. Major Sanborn and I attempted," this must be McElroy, "Major Sanborn and I attempted unsuccessfully to end the debate in February and March 1944 by the use of data collected from the German attacks on London. During that period, there was not a single instance of the spread of fire over a parapeted firewall. The notion that the endurance of firewalls was a decisive factor, whether in Berlin or London, of course, did not fit into the belief system of the strategic air war. The 19 major raids that made up the Battle of Berlin from August 1943 to March 1944, that's about six months, killed 9,390 civilians and 2,690 airmen. This was an astounding ratio for an operation that was supposed to decide the war. There was definitely no shortage of material. 10,813 bombers dropped 17,000 tons of high-explosive bombs and 16,000 tons of incendiaries. A similar mass of bombs fell on each resident of both Berlin and Hamburg, around 18 pounds. 18 pounds of bombs for each resident of the cities. But they worked in different ways. On October 22, 1943, Bomber Command succeeded in igniting its second firestorm. On October 3, they had been in Kassel, dismantling the Henschel Locomotive Works and an ammunition depot west of Eringshausen, but they missed the center of town. The following night, Frankfurt City Center was damaged. The Children's Hospital on Gangernstrasse suffered a direct hit to its air raid shelter. 90 children, 14 nurses, and a doctor died, as well as 414 other civilians. The 406 airplanes successfully set fires, but none of those fires even remotely resembled what 10 squadrons with 569 planes left behind after the second Kassel raid. In the 416,000 incendiary bombs fell in a density of up to 2 per square yard. 2 per square yard, thanks to the high precision marking. Most buildings in the city center were hit by many incendiary sticks and 2 liquid incendiaries. Kassel's old town became the city's undoing. On this evening in late fall, it was not hot as it had been in Hamburg, though it was very dry. The bomber stream extended for more than 90 miles. When the first wave started bombing at 8:45 p.m., the last wave was flying over Bonn, Koblenz. They managed a direct hit on the intended point, St. Martin's Square and St. Martin's Church, with the tomb of Landgrave Karl of Hesse-Kassel. Kassel, that's the name of the town. A rich ensemble of half-timbered buildings was preserved at the residence of the former Landgrave as the unparalleled pride of the local citizenry. This was just what Harris had been looking for. The powerful direct hit on this kindling most likely sufficed to set the entire city center ablaze within 15 minutes. The liquid incendiary bombs penetrated through all floors of all the buildings, setting fires from attic to basement. The high-capacity blockbusters tore away all roofs and windows within a radius of more than 500 yards, the flames moving as if through a chimney with the flue wide open. It became impossible to pass through stairwells and corridors. Although there were water reserves in cisterns, reservoirs, and especially the Fulda River, all of which were independent of the water mains, once the firestorm established its dimensions, it was absolutely impenetrable. A thousand-year-old city like Kassel, 1,000 years old, was built of materials that accelerated the process. The historical depth of such a construction quickened its inexorable demise. The firestorm required 45 minutes to reach its peak. It was not bothered significantly by the efforts of 6 firefighting squads and 2 turntable ladders. A city in the Ruhr Basin with neighboring fire departments that could offer quick aid would not have been as defenseless, but Kassel was isolated. The closest major town or city was 100 miles away. 1 in 10 people in the city center died in the raid on Kassel. In all, 10,000 lives were lost. That is a rate of 4.42%. In Hamburg, it was 2.73%. Not until almost a year later were a comparable number of people annihilated. But Darmstadt was only half as large, so the deaths made up 10.6% of the population. Firestorms and wide area conflagrations are closely related events. Though the lethality of the former is far greater and occurred less often. The fire weapon was more likely to evoke firestorms in medium-sized cities with historic centers. The fires in Hamburg and Dresden, which remain in our memories as monuments of the air war, are isolated examples. The air war was a war of attrition, in which the bombing of Brunswick is probably more characteristic than a Kassel or Dresden. A dozen major raids, 2,905 dead, and 80% of housing in the city center destroyed. 33% of the housing overall. By far, most of the losses were borne by 158 medium-sized German cities. Well, that's where I was going to stop. I've still got a couple of minutes in this first segment. What he's saying is that even though these cities that are mentioned having the most devastating consequences because they were larger cities and they were bombed so many times, but they didn't make up the brunt of the destruction in Germany, which was really all the other cities, which nobody ever hears about. He says here, 158 medium-sized German cities. Most of the losses were born in those cities, even though we have the high numbers in the large cities. So this is still in chapter 2 that I'm reading from, which is strategy. It's a very interesting chapter. And when I get through with this one, I don't know how much more of it I will read. Then we go to chapter 3, which is about the land. And that takes us to lots of descriptions of just exactly what was destroyed. I wouldn't try to read a whole lot of that, but I will find some interesting parts of the places that are well known that tells, and we'll see all the things that and the age of these places and the special architecture and so on that were gone, that are gone forever. So we'll be right back, ladies and gentlemen, and after this news break.
We'll be right back with more on The Heretics Hour. You're listening to VOR, ReasonRadioNetwork.com.
Questions remain over Iran's nuclear program after UN atomic officials said Tehran had failed to cooperate with them. The international community is suspecting that Tehran is building a nuclear bomb, but Iran insists it's only seeking peaceful atomic energy. The US and its allies have been imposing tough economic sanctions, while Israel's even threatened military action against Iran's nuclear sites. But it's being reported that America's intelligence community now has got doubts about the nuclear allegations. Let's try and get some more thoughts on all this and talk to Middle East consultant Peter Ray, who joins us on the line from Birmingham in England. Peter, very good evening from Moscow. The UN Nuclear Agency says Iran stepped up uranium enrichment. Now, how does that sit with that other leaked report we've been hearing in the Los Angeles Times, where intelligence agencies say they don't think a bomb is being built?
I personally don't think there is any intention by Iran to go down that particular road. What you have to understand is this standoff with Syria, Iran and all the rest of the Middle Eastern concerns is basically a geopolitical plan for regime change. We saw it in Libya, we're now seeing it in Syria, and the same exercise in Iran. There is clearly a Zionist overtone, an Israeli overtone on the way politics is run in the West, because they dictate the ground rules, they provide the finances, and so the politicians do what they ask for. The other issue here is that there's definitely a Muslim standoff between Shiite and Sunni. And Sunni, of course, Saudi and all the other countries are definitely against the Shiite. We see this in Bahrain, where the majority of the population is Shiite, but they have no voice at all in politics. They talk about democracy in Egypt, but we still don't have democracy in Egypt, because Israel and the US and the UK are to make sure that there is a sort of a Western-friendly government in power. And so the military still control Egypt. That is not democracy. There's no democracy in Bahrain. Syria is a duplication of Libya. There's no question about that. It is a forced regime change and nothing else.
But
carry on, sorry.
Let's focus back in on Iran. Up until last August, at least, I spoke to President Ahmadinejad then personally. We did an interview with him, and he said that, as far as he was concerned, he was happy that atomic officials were being given the access they needed. That was his side of it. That's what he told us. Now, UN atomic officials saying Iran is refusing to cooperate with them during the last two visits in recent months, and so therefore they can't provide assurances that there are no nuclear weapons there. Do you think Iran could be doing a better PR job, if you like? Do you think it should be more transparent, i.e. it's not helping its cause here?
I don't think it's necessary for a country to be so cooperative to the powers that be that are against them.
We'll be right back.
Let's return to the Heretics Hour, brought to you by VOR, ReasonRadioNetwork.com. And now here's Carolyn.
Welcome back, listeners. This is the Heretics Hour with Carolyn Yeager. And now, here's Rodney.
Good evening, Carolyn. Thanks for having me back.
You're welcome.
I think tonight's topic we talked about, we were going to talk about health and scientific achievements under the National Socialist government. And, I think, putting things in proper context, I think that it's important to understand that there was the pre-war period, which is 1933 to 1939, and then from 1939 to 1945, there was the war period. So it's important for people to understand that from 1939 to 1945, the emphasis in Germany was to win the war and to develop technology that would have a primary basis in winning the war. But after the war, there would be applications after the war. So some of the items, and it would be impossible in the time that we have to cover all of the innovations that were developed between 1933 and 1945, both in peacetime innovations in the health and science fields, and then those type of items that were covered under wartime. We'd be here all night and all day tomorrow and well into next week. So I've taken some of the highlights, and some of these are well-known, but I'd like to expand upon them a little bit. But I think it's important for people to realize, because the narrative that's most commonly heard by what I call propagandist historians is there was nothing of any value or merit that came out of National Socialist Germany that was worth having. If that was to be the case, then why was over 300,000 patents and copyrights expropriated from Germany by the Allies after 1945?
Wow.
That's an astonishing number.
Mm-hmm.
That's not my number. That's not me making this up. That's in the historical record. There was over 300,000 patents and copyrights that Germany was told. Of course, keep in mind that Germany did not exist. The Dönitz government was told, you do not exist. Germany does not have a government. It was called the Allied Control Council. So anything that was German, the Soviet Union, Britain, the United States, and even France, which had surrendered in 1940, was told, take what you want. It's a swap meet, except you don't have to pay. So all these copyrights and patents on scientific achievements that had been developed in the prior 12 years, now bear in mind, we're told today, nothing of value was developed. All this was taken. And imitation is the, sincerest form of flattery or theft. And so obviously there must have been something of value and merit, or the Allies wouldn't have stolen 300,000 patents and copyrights. And those are only the ones that were documented. But let's talk about health for just a little while. The most common fictitious narrative is if you start talking about health about National Socialist Germany, you hear, all those mean, vicious, and macabre medical experiments in the concentration camps. And, you hear about, it was all racial hygiene and such. Well, first of all, bear in mind that there's really nothing wrong with racial hygiene. It was practiced in the United States of America. There was racial hygiene laws in California right up until about 1968. There must not have been that much wrong with it, per se. But let's take the most common talked about, health achievement in National Socialist Germany, which was, smoking. National Socialist Germany was the first, nation to actually conduct medical studies that drew concrete conclusiveness that there was a link between cancer and tobacco use and smoking, and they took steps. Years.
And when was this first done, Rodney?
Well, I'll give you a break. It started pre-war, and actually, believe it or not, this was one of the pre-war initiatives that extended and the research continued into the war. And at one point, and I'll give you the exact number out of my notes here, there was an institute that was formed in 1943, well into the war, about 24 months before the war was over. And it was the Bureau Against the Dangers of Alcohol and Tobacco Use, and that was formed in 1939. But in 1943, the institute commission was the first formal case control study of smoking and lung cancer. The institute from which the study came was supported by an initial 100,000 Reichmark contribution from Adolf Hitler's personal finances himself.
Oh, that's I believe that. That's very interesting, because I just wanted to throw in here, which I know you know, Adolf Hitler was very much against smoking. He hated smoking. He banned smoking in his presence, in his home, in the offices, inside the buildings, the government buildings and so on, and everybody had to go outside to smoke. And that's what took us in the United States until when 1980s or something to finally agree to that, and we were very resistant to it because we thought that everybody had a right to do what they wanted to do, even if it was harmful to themselves. That's a liberty.
Well, in some cases, Carolyn, in the United States, it wasn't until the 90s that they didn't have smoking in public buildings, but it went beyond that of Hitler. In 1939, Hermann Göring issued a decree forbidding the military from smoking on the streets during marches or on off-duty periods. And in 1942, the Federation of German Women launched a campaign against tobacco and alcohol misuse. But it goes back, and there was a whole broader implication, which we're going to talk about as we go into the program. The Federation of German Women and the fact that they had engaged, and you see there was a whole cross-pollinization of the various, say, what we would call stakeholders today, but in Germany it was called the Volk. This was a folkish effort to of healthy bodies and address issues of common concern. But particularly with women, this cancer battle had a much broader meaning. Adolf Hitler's mother died of breast cancer.
Yeah, yeah.
And he used to go with her to her medical appointments and personally watched her suffering. Of course, at that time, when she passed away, I believe it was in 1907, there wasn't a whole lot that could be done for breast cancer. And so this was something that had a tremendous impact on Adolf Hitler. And as a leader, he made this a tremendous public policy issue to address, and a fundamental public policy war on cancer. But beyond this, what's little known is the German population, and perhaps this is Jeanette, had suffered from high cancer rates, breast cancer in women, stomach cancer, and lung cancer, and of course, the institute that was formed in 1939 had drawn a proven scientific correlation to smoking. So you've seen this tremendous folkish effort amongst the National Socialist government to, you know, basically, based on scientific evidence, to address this public health hazard. This crossed over cancer. Just, it wasn't not just on smoking. I mean, that was once the scientific study and data was in. But they also, as it related to women and breast cancer, it was the first nation. You know, it wasn't too terribly long ago here in the United States we started seeing the PR campaign about women should go and get the mammograms every so many years. It, you know, we're talking about maybe 20 years, Carolyn. That really became a public policy and became the...
That was in the 70s.
Yeah, okay. So we go back a little bit further.
Yeah.
National Socialist Germany had a public PR effort started before the war for women to get exams for breast cancer. So that would put them 40 years ahead of time, if the math serves me right. Roughly, there was an effort. And if you look hard enough, you can find some of the public information announcements where the health offices at the time, the Reich health offices, and the German Women's Federation were encouraging and women to be examined, have exams, regular exams.
Yeah.
For breast cancer.
Okay, let's go on with some more of the things so that we're going to run out of time and we won't get everything covered. What else was in health? What else did they do in the field of health?
Well, here's a major one, and this was National Socialist Germany was the first country to identify asbestos as a cancer-causing agent.
Okay.
And, of course, as part of the theft of materials from Germany after the war, the findings of the National Socialist government's scientific research on asbestos was used in American litigation against major asbestos companies. Now, we see about mesothelioma and lung cancer mm-hmm. from asbestos mm-hmm. today, but that's not relatively new today. One of the first cases back in the 50s was based on scientific data compiled during the National Socialist government, and there was an effort to look at alternatives for asbestos, mainly in shipping. And, of course, you know, by this time we're talking 4 years all-out effort in war, and there just wasn't time, you know, there wasn't the time to come up with the alternatives. But that was the first nation to develop that. Let me get back real briefly. Again, talking about this, and I can't stress this enough. In 1944, late in the war, all smoking was banned on trains and buses in the cities. This is included by Wehrmacht troops who are home on leave. So I think this is really interesting that this was a major national effort, way ahead of their time.
Mm-hmm.
Getting into the health issue, also almost initially all of the initial data, health-wise, that we initially learned on the effects of hypothermia, we learned from National Socialist medical research.
That's right.
Now, this is a touchy subject, because when you mention this, the first thing propagandist historians will bring up, they'll show those horrible pictures. And there's one in particular that shows couple of medical doctors conducting an experiment. What they will not tell you is, yes, there was some camp experimentation done, but what they won't tell you is that a large amount of the experimentation was done on volunteers of particularly Luftwaffe pilots who had to fly, you know, altitudes where it's even colder, and on ground troops from the Wehrmacht from the Eastern Front on those horrible Russian winters.
Well, this work was done. Some of this work was done at Dachau concentration camp, was it not?
Yes.
I did some research on this for something I was writing a few years ago. And you know, they go on and on about how they use prisoners. Well, once again, the facts that came out were that they were mostly volunteers who were already condemned to death. And if they survived the experiments, which it was true, some, you know, they didn't all survive these experiments, but some did. And if they survived, they would have their sentence lifted and be a free person. So it wasn't as evil as they make it out to be at all. And none of the experimental work they did was. Let's see if you can, when you finish this up, let's go into the animal rights thing, too.
I didn't get too much into the animal rights. I was hoping to talk into another show on that as a social policy.
Oh, okay. Okay.
Because actually, you're absolutely right. They were very progressive in terms of their legislation and their animal rights legislation.
Oh, yeah.
That remains on the books today, and a lot of people don't realize now.
They were the first to do it.
They won't like the reminder them of that. But let me get back to some of these health issues. And then as far as what you just touched on, as far as camp inmates volunteering for some of these experiments, let me give you real briefly from my notes an example. Dr. Edward Wirth and his brother pioneered a significant amount of research as it related to ovarian and cervical cancer in women, both before the war and after, in particular, uterine cancer and cervical cancer. And they worked right up until the end of the war, And as a matter of fact, Dr. Edward Worth committed suicide while in captivity. And interestingly, there were signed declarations from many of the women, and interestingly, women that were already diagnosed with ovarian or uterine cancer or such. And so he essentially, one could argue, and there's been a tremendous amount of debate, one can argue that he was actually treating them while engaging in medical research. And let me stop out here real quick. It's really interesting. Carolyn, if you go to Los Angeles and open up these free periodicals that basically target low-income people and low-educated people, and then some cases the LA Times, you will get these solicitations from major hospitals, UCLA,
sure,
where they'll give you $300 if you allow yourself to be a medical guinea pig.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so tell me, if you check yourself into UCLA and they give you $300 and they let you carve on you, what's the difference in what these camp inmates freely, by all accounts, and here, getting back to Dr. Wirtz, you had prisoners, inmates, that signed declarations saying that he was very honorable, very courteous, treated them well, and they survived the war and into old age. And in his suicide note, he noted that he abided by his, quote, Christian faith and tried to do right by his profession as a physician, tried to treat and cure cancer and uphold the canons of his profession.
Mm-hmm.
So, I thought that was a good example there, and, given what you had you brought up. Getting back to some of the other advancements, homeopathic medicine, which, in, you know, since there's been a lot of debate in the United States the last, 10, 12 years about health care, alternative health care, homeopathic health care was pioneered and encouraged in International Socialist Germany both before the war and even during the war. And we're talking about a period of, 50, 60 years before it become, vogue here in the United States and elsewhere in the West. It was something, there was a term for it, and I believe it was referred to as folkish medicine, but it was encouraged. It was nearly on equal footing as regular medicine. It had almost near co-equal status, and it was something that was encouraged. The debate that we're having today, particularly in healthcare, about, hey, you shouldn't have cradle-to-grave healthcare for a person that, or have the same health care rates for a person that takes care of themselves, eats healthy, exercises, as opposed to a person that sits on the couch all day eating junk food. And National Socialist Germany, the promotion of a healthy diet, fruit and vegetable.
There was something called the New German Medicine, or
exactly,
German New Medicine, and it was a preventive approach based on hygiene and health management and the maintenance of good health as a duty. You know, I like
there
this approach. You know, this was the National Socialist approach to a lot of things. It said, it is your duty as a citizen, and this is where the racial thing comes in. It is not a bad thing at all. Your duty to take care of yourself so that you can be of benefit to the whole nation, and so things like that. And this started as early as 1934, they had an association for herbal medicine at the Rudolf Krell Clinic. And this went on all through the Third Reich period. And I have a lot of information on that, but that has a lot to do with these agricultural and herb farms that Himmler set up. The SS
Rudolf Hess and Heinrich Himmler were very much supporters and advocates of the alternative medicine, the herbal medicine and the homeopathic approach. They were very much supporters of that approach.
But I have to tell you that just to be clear here to the listeners, Hitler was not as crazy about that as they were. He let them go ahead with it, but that wasn't his thing. Although the anti-smoking and he didn't drink and just his ideas of health, but he kind of went along with regular medicine more. But Himmler and the SS were going into this alternative kind of stuff. and it was allowed.
There was by far not unanimity in the leadership as far as approaches on a lot of things, which we could probably touch on in the future as well.
Well, you mentioned that right now. Wasn't. There was a lot of freedom, and people had their ideas and were, you know, promoted them, and it wasn't like some kind of dictate from the top.
You know, if we could take just 30 seconds here, people have this because of propagandists, historians, people have a misunderstanding and purposely, you know, perpetrated of National Socialist Germany as being this totalitarian tyrant. And totalitarian has been a word that's been abused as well, of being a tyrant. Let's do a real quick 30-second analogy. In Soviet Russia under Stalin, if you had a sit-down dinner with him and you disagreed with him, you disappeared that night. Whereas with Adolf Hitler, he would have these long evenings at the Berghof, and this is recorded in table talk. And you could disagree with him, and he would engage you in debate and would sometimes laugh you off and all that, but there was a free flowing of ideas and discussions. As a matter of fact, they thrived on that. And sometimes he would mock some of his, you know, people that he had real close friends with. He'd say, well, that's Himmler's thing, that's not mine, or that's Reich Marshal Goering's thing, but that's not necessarily mine. It was a world of ideas. And whereas these other, you know, like Soviet Russia was actually not a world of ideas by any means. And that's what made that society so dynamic and was responsible for a lot of the innovations in such a short. Remember, this all happened in just 12 years. You know, they only had about, well, 1933 to 1939, they only had 6 years of peacetime. And between 33 and 35, they're, you know, those really don't count per se because they were consolidating their authority and, you know, rebuilding the economy. And then they went into, you know, the war was forced upon them, and then you had to go to war. So really, it was a remarkable achievement in those 12 years to accomplish a lot of these scientific and medical achievements that they did. But getting back to some of these other, let me touch real briefly, too, on the asbestos and lead and mercury. They were big also on contamination and purification of water, and we'll get into this too as well. National Socialist Germany re-engineered and perfected the science of wastewater treatment and sewage treatment because they were big on water purification and drinking water. Also, as I said, they proved that asbestos had a direct link as a health hazard to cancer, and this was done in 1943 actually, and that research was actually used later on by big United States law firms.
Yeah, you said that
against the John Fincher Corporation. So it's just amazing that all of this medical research and data.
Well, are there any more? We've only got a few more minutes in this segment, Randy. Rodney, are there any more health things that you wanted to bring up?
No, those are the hallmarks. I think those are the hallmarks. I think we've condensed that all. The scientific ones are ones that I really have a lot of information on as we go into the second.
Well, I don't know if you wanted to talk about their health for mothers and so on, but there was a popular health manual that they were advising pregnant women to avoid alcohol and nicotine and nursing mothers and so on.
Well, real quickly, the last few minutes, there was two also. Under National Socialist Germany, you know, back in those days, there wasn't such a thing as an epidural to ease the pain of
childbirth,
labor pains. So they actually created a medication called Pethidine, which was created, and that was as a result of their development of methadone. And the reason why they created the drug methadone was Germany did not want to be held hostage. The whole concept under National Socialism was to be self-sufficient. And bear in mind, there were certain resources that Germany did not have, and one of them was obviously opium was a derivative of a major painkiller at that time. And they did not want to be over-reliant on the nation of Turkey. So German pharmaceuticals developed what became known as methadone, which is still used in the United States today. And that was one of the patents that was taken in 1945 But when they developed methadone, one of the big issues was the labor pain, and they developed that ancillary drug to ease with the with labor pains.
Mm. Okay.
And then with the healthy, wealthy mothers, that was a big issue. That was a big, big, big fundamental basis of national socialism. And let me give you a book we're going to the next hour.
Yep. Yes, we are. All right, ladies and gentlemen, my guest is Rodney Martin, and we'll be back in about 5 minutes after this news break to continue. Stay with us.
We'll be right back with more on The Heretics Hour. You're listening to VOR, ReasonRadioNetwork.com.
From Feature Story News in Washington, I'm Priscilla Huff. The referendum on a new constitution for Syria has been denounced as a sham by the international community, as the Syrian military continues to shell cities and towns, including Homs. The latest attempt to evacuate the injured from Homs by the International Red Crescent Society has ended in failure. Saudi Arabia and Qatar are openly urging the arming of the Syrian resistance, while China says the U.S. policy toward Syria is super arrogant and the Russians are warning against any end run around the United Nations process. However, back in Washington, after U.S. Secretary of State Hillary Clinton called China and Russia despicable for voting against the U.N. resolutions, U.S. State Department spokeswoman Victoria Nuland said the regime of Bashar al-Assad will come to an end.
He is going to go down. It is a matter of time. And as the secretary has said, they really need to think about what side they want to be on when that happens and about the positive humanitarian role they could play right now if they were willing to do the right thing.
A student has been killed and four others injured in a shooting at an American high school. A lone gunman, also believed to be a student, opened fire in the cafeteria of Chardon High School near Cleveland. Our U.S. correspondent Steve Mort reports.
So far, authorities say they have no motive for the shooting. Students say the gunman opened fire on a group of friends sitting at a table in the school cafeteria, killing one and injuring four. Those nearby described the scene as the shooting took place.
He pulled a gun out and just started shooting kids, and I saw the one drop, and I ran.
We kept running, and we just sprinted down to the end of the hallway, and we found safety there.
The family of the student killed in the attack released a statement saying they were torn by the loss.
The United Nations is evacuating an office in northern Afghanistan. The office was attacked over the weekend as demonstrators protest against the burning of the Quran. Last week, the Quran and other Islamic publications were burned at Bagram Air Base, an incident which NATO and the U.S. says was accidental. Our correspondent Nicole Israel has the latest from the United Nations.
The United Nations says it's moving international staff from an office in northern Afghanistan that was attacked last week by demonstrators protesting the burning of Qurans by U.S. troops. U.S. officials said the books were mistakenly sent with a pile of trash for disposal before several Afghans identified them. The U.N. says in a statement that the evacuation in the town of Kunduz is temporary and that staffers will be relocated elsewhere in Afghanistan until the organization is sure the office can operate safely. At least three protesters died and 50 were injured in Kunduz on Saturday when crowds attacked the UN office and government buildings. Nicole Israel, New York.
Some are suspicious about the news of a plot to assassinate Russian Prime Minister Vladimir Putin. The plot was uncovered less than 1 week before the Russian presidential election. Two suspects were detained in Odessa by Ukrainian officials. Vladimir Putin is expected to win the vote. From bureaus worldwide, this is FSN.
Let's return to the Heretics Hour, brought to you by VOR, ReasonRadioNetwork.com. And now here's Carolyn.
Well, welcome back, ladies and gentlemen, to our second hour tonight. And my guest is Rodney Martin, and we are talking about, I'm Carolyn Yeager, and this is the Heretics Hour, and we're talking about Nazi Germany's firsts in science, medicine, and health. And we've talked a lot about the health firsts, and now, and we've gone somewhat, and we've gone into the medicine. We're now going to expand a little bit into synthetic things that were developed. I want to remind you that this is, you can call in during this hour if you have something to add or ask about what about this topic. The number is 1-855-477-2283. Now, Rodney, we were saying that you were saying that Germany doesn't have much natural resources, and so they have to develop synthetics. So what are some of the most important synthetic products that they developed during this period?
Well, let's give you an idea. That one natural resource that Germany did have in the Ruhr was coal, which gave them an idea. But they didn't have, you know, natural oil. They didn't have, like, the oil fields of Caliste and Romania, you know, that, you know, once they would lose those or they get bombed, they got to thinking, we need an alternative. So the, you know, the German engineering, the, you know, great German mind, they developed synthetic fuel, you know, from coal. There was no indigenous supplies of petroleum in Germany. So, you know, Hitler began assembling a, you know, large industrial complex to manufacture some petroleum from coal supplies, which the Germans do have an abundant supply of coal. And so by, you know, at one point, the Germans were producing about 125,000 barrels of synthetic fuel per day from about 25 plants. And this was obviously equally as some of the other innovations impressive, particularly to the United States. And this was picked up, and some demonstration plants were eventually of converting coal to gasoline was built by the United States Bureau of Mines in Louisiana and Missouri, and one in West Virginia after World War II. So, I mean, there's another example. And they did the same thing with rubber as well, starting in 1935. German chemists began working and developing some polymers to come up with synthetic rubber. And let me give you a fun one for the audience. There's a real there's a fun one. Coca-Cola was very popular in Germany. There's pictures of Wehrmacht officers under Coca-Cola signs in various parts of Europe drinking Coca-Cola. As a matter of fact, you can look it up. There was Coca-Cola in the what was the precursor of refrigerators, even at the Berghof. I don't know if there's any reported incidents of Hitler drinking it, but certainly there was.
No, no, he didn't drink it. But I think Eva Braun liked it.
Yeah, but anyway, by 1941, there was no more Coca-Cola in Germany, and the remaining stocks were getting very low. And so what was the former Coca-Cola executives in Germany, you know, they formed a German company, wanted to create a new German soft drink based on the materials that the Germans can get. And that became what we all see around today called Fanta. Fanta soft drink, which we all see in grocery stores, which is a big seller for the Coca-Cola Corporation. They took that as well after the war and is very popular throughout the world and very different. It's a fruit flavor. It's a fruit-based drink.
Yeah, isn't Fanta the orange colored and orange taste?
It's orange, strawberry, pineapple. They're very different. But when everybody I want to remind the audience, when you go get a Fanta Cola, that was developed in Nazi Germany when they were no longer able to get the Coca-Cola syrup. That is a 100% history and lineage of that comes from National Socialist Germany. It's a very good sort of pop.
Now, now you're going to kill the sales for Fanta.
Anyway, on to some other items. There's a big misconception that, you know, let's talk about space and rocket. And what I want to dissuade everybody is there's a lot of fictitious garbage on the internet about Nazis on the moon and all of that. That's all hogwash and space aliens and all that. You know, we need to keep it real. And when you talk about the first manned rocket flight, a lot of people think John Glenn, and they think of the Saturn programs, which is interesting because all of those Saturn rockets were developed and designed by Wernher von Braun, who developed the first rockets under National Socialist Germany, but we'll get to that later. But actually, the first manned rocket flight was in National Socialist Germany in late 1944 by the German Lothar Sieber. And he flew the Messerschmitt 163 Comet, which was essentially a rocket with small wings on it. And that was so a lot of people don't realize that, but it is true. The first manned rocket flight took place under the National Socialist German regime. And like I said, as we said at the onset of the program, some of this stuff intertwined. You know, it was used for war purposes, but it had other purposes as well that have broad, far-sweeping implications in the eventual race to the moon and the space program. And I'm going to digress here for a little bit. After the war, so successful and so, you know, impressed by the German rocket program that the Soviets and the Americans were rushing to find the scientists and stored them away under an operation called Operation Paperclip. But what was interesting is they brought them over to the United States and stored them in New Mexico and didn't do nothing with them. All the while, the Soviets were launching Sputnik and launching the rockets. It wasn't until after Sputnik and some of the other American rocket engineers just couldn't quite get the job done, did the Americans and NASA actually bring in von Braun and his German crew. And at that point in the American space program, the Soviets could never catch up. And that is true. It cannot be denied. Hmm. So moving on.
And what about the jet airplane?
Which I'm getting on to that as well. But this, let me get to the jet next. But stealth technology, and this is something that was just proven. A lot of people believe that the American stealth, and I don't know the numerical designation, that was the first stealth aircraft, and now we know for a fact that the German Horten HO-229 not only was the first operational flying wing, but it was the first stealth bomber years before the stealth bomber that was flown in 1991 against Iraq. We know that to be fact because it was rebuilt out here in California by an aircraft and defense contractor. It was rebuilt to spec, and they proved by scientific testing that not only was it an operational flying wing, but it was a it had stealth capability, and the British radars would never have saw it.
But how far? It was still in the experimental stage. I mean, it wasn't in the production stage.
They had produced, I think, two, and they had
weren't really producing it. Yeah,
that's right. You're absolutely correct.
Yeah, but they were producing jets.
Yes, and that's my next topic. The under the National Socialist Germany, the first operational jet fighter and the first operational jet bomber were produced. That was the Me-262, which was the jet, and then the Arado AR-234, which was the bomber. And now those were fantastic aircraft, and some may not know or not, but I am a big fan and a buff of aircraft, particularly Luftwaffe aircraft.
You know, our friend Wilhelm Christman, who's done programs here, he flew the Arado jet.
Oh, okay.
Uh-huh.
Well, this set the stage basically with the operation of these two aircraft. This basically brought an end to, you know, to a one generation of aircraft and the introduction of the next generation of aircraft. And for instance, to just give you a statistic, the 262 fighter jet, because they were refining the technology and some of the getting the bugs out of the system, it came online in June of 1944. and it was responsible for 542 Allied kills. It had a loss of 100, only lost 100 ME-262s, and those were mainly, the only time the Allied planes could get those were either on the ground, parked, or at takeoff and landing. They were literally invincible in the air, and contrary to the fiction of the new movie Red Tails, the Negro air aces, which were unreliable, did not shoot down ME-262s with prop planes. It just really didn't happen. It just didn't happen. And, of course, now a little note about the Arado jet bomber. It was the last Luftwaffe aircraft to fly a bombing mission over England, and that was April of 1945.
Mm-hmm.
They were flying bombing missions that late in the war. Now, here's a big one. And this one can never go this is basically one that still has historical significance to this day and will forever. The first ballistic missile was developed and put into operation under National Socialist Germany. The V-1, to a lesser extent, but basically the V-2, that was Wernher von Braun's and Dornberger's baby. And, of course, that sent shockwaves throughout the world. One can only imagine if the Germans had put Tabun gas in the head of one of those and dropped it on the Russians as they advanced into Eastern Europe. I think the world would be a different place. However, Hitler did not have the same diabolical mind as Churchill. Churchill once planned and wanted to drop poison gas on Berlin, and that never crossed Hitler's mind. But the V-1 was the precursor for all of the, not only ballistic missiles, but all of the rockets that followed, that went to the moon, you know, that that basically pioneered space exploration that followed. It cannot ever be denied that Wernher von Braun rescued NASA, and it resulted with the subsequent trips to the moon and basically built modern NASA. Now, NASA has been gutted and destroyed, and whether or not we'll ever, you know, have a NASA that's as exciting as those days, that's remains to be seen.
Yeah,
jumping
probably
back,
not.
Just a step to the ME-262 jet. The ME-262 jet, Carolyn, was the precursor to the Sabre, the American Sabre jets, and the first MiG. The Soviets and the Americans took those ones they could find, and they basically developed their own swap-wing jet aircraft. And they were the precursor of all the modern jet fighters that would follow. This is a wartime scientific innovation that the world really took notice that nobody pays much attention to, was the Type 21 U-boats that were developed late in the war. And again, this is a wartime innovation, but the reason why this is really critical is one, if you look at the design of the Type 21 U-boat and look at the designs of the American and subsequent Western nations, including Soviet U-boats that followed, they're almost identical. They follow that design. But the Type 21 was designed to basically operate, the first submarine to operate extensively for prolonged periods of time underwater. Prior to the development of the Type 21, the submarines had to surface and operate for a prolonged period of time on the surface to recharge batteries and such. The Type 21 was basically the next generation of submarines and was basically the new generation of submarines until the advent of nuclear submarines. And so impressed with the Type 21, France grabbed a couple. In fact, they took the U-2518 and put it into service under a new name and operated it until 1967. And then used it as a trainer until 1969. The Soviet Union grabbed four of them and kept them into operation under new designations until the late 50s and early 60s. England took one, ended up with the U-3017, operated it for 10 years. And the United States took three of them. And actually, Harry Truman became the first U.S. president to take a dive in a German U-boat, and that was a Type 21. And the United States operated Type 21 U-boats that it commandeered for about 10 years.
There you go.
It was just interesting. They say, you know, copying and stealing.
Yeah. Well, they're not as great as they say they are. They
they steal, and then they accuse the Nazis of stealing art and stealing, you know, whatever they can accuse them of stealing, where they didn't even steal the art. Okay, what about the helicopter was developed by the Germans? And the first helicopters were used during the National Socialist period. Hannah Reich was one of the ones who flew them and tested them.
She also was the second or third. Hannah Reich. Now here is another misnomer. The misnomer of National Socialism is that National Socialists makes their women walk two or three steps behind the men, and there's not an equal footing. Okay, Hannah Reich was awarded the Iron Cross by none other than Adolf Hitler himself. She actually was the test pilot on the helicopter, but she also test flew a couple of the operational jet aircraft as well.
Mm-hmm. Sure, she was
a remarkable, strong woman.
Yeah, by 1943, she started testing all kinds of aircraft. But before that, she was a specialist in gliders, and gliders are another aircraft that were developed by the Germans. I think they were invented by the Germans, and it was not so long ago. I mean, it was back around that time in the 20s, 30s, and she first flew gliders. And the whole development of what you call the perfection of the gliders and so on is all due to the Germans, and then they taught it to other peoples.
Yes, absolutely. Of course, you know, Hannah Reich also took during battlefield conditions under artillery fire in 1945, landed a reconnaissance plane that had been hit by artillery, landed it on a city street, and that takes, you know, that's quite a pilot. You know, there's a lot of male pilots who would say that they would have trouble doing that. And this is a woman that took the controls from a wounded pilot and landed it under battlefield conditions.
Well, she was an exceptional pilot. She had an exceptional ability to stay calm and to endure stresses. And they recognized that, although they were shocked, you know, when they saw the kind of good piloting she was doing when she was still in schools. In school, mm-hmm. learning it, but eventually they recognized it, and she was finally allowed to do everything that the men were able to do. And she was only 5'1".
You know, she was invited to the White House, President Kennedy's White House in 1962, mm-hmm. for her feats in gliding, because she did do some gliding after the war. That's all the Germans were allowed to do for
about she went back to gliding, and I think that's about all she did once she was allowed to fly again in the 50s.
But what's interesting is there's a group photograph of her with President Kennedy and the other female gliders, but she was the only one that got invited into the Oval Office for a one-on-one conversation with President Kennedy. He had some questions he wanted to ask her. So one could wonder what he wanted to ask her.
I didn't know that.
Yes, he did that. He did invite her in and had a discussion, and that was, you know, we'll never know what he wanted to know. But getting back to some of the other scientific feats, we see on particularly since the 1991 Gulf War, we've seen these little devices on the helmets, particularly the U.S. combat troops, these night vision goggles, these night vision devices. Well, those were first, you know, the IR technologies. Those were developed during the Third Reich, during Nazi Germany. And these night vision devices, these were being developed and perfected at a time, you know, the Allied troops, particularly the United States and England, they were still scratching their heads trying to understand if this was even, you know, plausible. And the Germans were developing the technology to actually, put it into combat use. And, of course, today, night vision, law enforcement uses night vision. Border patrols use night vision. And this all started during the period of the Third Reich. And here's a fun one. You know, the first practical tape recorder, and then, of course, the magnetic recording tape, this mm-hmm. first practical tape recorder was developed during the Third Reich.
Mm-hmm.
And,
that's right.
You know, it was called a magnetophone, and they were widely used for German radio broadcasts. Because they were compartmentalized, they could be moved rather easily, and they were used for radio broadcasts during the war, and they were rather closely guarded secrets. But a couple of them were discovered during when the Allies actually pushed into Germany.
That's right. And they didn't know what it was. They were quite amazed at this thing that they found.
Yeah, and actually, they finally decided what it was because an American found one in a radio station outside of Frankfurt, or in Frankfurt, in 45, right at the end of the war. And he ended up taking that back to the United States and demonstrated to Bing Crosby the technology, and it became, you know, another one of those items that we can say was borrowed permanently. You know, the patent and such was borrowed permanently by the United States. Mm-hmm. But an amazing device. And I remember when I was in college and worked in the radio station and saw those magnetic reel-to-reel tape recorders. One could only think, you know, that's where it originated. That was the original, yep. And that's where it was born. And, of course, the magnetic tape, you know, AEG, the German electronics company, the one that actually began to develop it. And, here's one that is really, really fascinating. And we talked about this on prior shows, and this kind of crosses over. We talked previously, Carol, and on prior shows about how competitive and, of course, in some cases, superior German film was, and about how the misnomer is that, you know, film supremacy rests with Hollywood. And, of course, you think of television broadcasting, you think United States, you think of all of the TV stations. Well, actually, television broadcasting, the beaming of television from, you know, place to place to place to place, you think, you know, that didn't come about, per se, in the United States, per se, big, you know, until, you know, the 50s, per se. You know, really on a, you know, as a perfected art. Well, the 1936 Olympics was broadcast by television, the television parlors. You know, the Germans were 20 years ahead.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, well, the Germans invented, they had the first television. Yes, they did. Yes. And it was during Hitler's regime.
Yes. And, you know, the more they were opening archives.
I don't know how good that turned out to be, but anyway, you know, it was quite an amazing invention that they did.
The television, the screens, they were, for their time, they were very good. The content, I mean, they're actually developing television programs. Mm-hmm. You know, they weren't, you know, back too long. Of course, when I was a kid, you didn't have
they're recording.
Television programming. Yeah, but, I mean, they had variety programs, you know, mm-hmm. they had those type of programs. But the fact of the matter is, television programming, the fact of beaming television waves from point to point to point throughout the German Reich or throughout the country, let's put it in comparison to comparison, was already developed and was being put into place on a grander scale a full 20 years ahead of its time. Mm. And, I mean, that can't go on as a historical fact.
Yeah.
And along those lines, there's something that was just, you know, revealed just in November of last year, 2011. And film director who did a fascinating film in 1973 called Swastika, in which he just took films that were made at the Berghof and other places in Germany, and he put them on film without any talking. He didn't add any narration or anything, and he did some of the voiceovers and such, much like the private voice of Adolf Hitler, which they tried to do a couple of years ago. Well, Felipe Mora did this back in 1973 based on German films. So he spent a lot of time going through some of the old German archives. Well, he found in November of 2011 the fact that 3D movies were first developed in National Socialist Germany. He found that as of that time, I haven't followed it like I should have, he had found 2 to 3 films shot in essentially 3D, and these were done in pre-war, before the war. And, you know, this was done before Hollywood's technology mm-hmm. had moved on. These films were done in 35 millimeter, according to Moore. And so they were made by the independent studio. From the information he had found so far as of November of last year, they were done by Gribble's Ministry, and which was... it was called ROM film or space film, and he said the films were so real you can touch them, the effects. He said, and these were films that were done in the 30s. They were done prior to 1939. And he, at that time,
go ahead.
Yeah. Yeah, he was still researching when they were made, who was in them and all that, but he said the quality of these 3D films made prior to 1939 were so good.
Mm-hmm. Well, there were a lot of cinematic innovations. You know, so you would be familiar with some of them, like that Riefenstahl used when she did her Olympics film, where she had all these cameras on the ground, or she had 20 cameras, or I don't know how that works. I don't have it in front of me, but things that no one had ever done before. And that's that creative German spirit at work. Well, we'll be right back, ladies and gentlemen. This is...
We'll be right back with more on The Heretics Hour. You're listening to VOR, ReasonRadioNetwork.com.
Euro sentiment was riding high after Spain joined the Eurozone back in 2002. But a decade on and years of austerity have brought us all back to earth with an economic crash.
We are against the government policies, and we want an education of quality for our kids.
The latest round of cuts and reforms sparked nationwide protests in Spain, in Valencia, and it was the students leading the way as they took their complaints out of the classroom and onto the Spanish streets.
And we're spending millions like we're rich, but actually we're seeing that we're not rich at all. I mean, we have... high schools without heating, you know, there's no money. They're cutting where they shouldn't. They're cutting in the low-income people. And they just don't see anything that's... They think it's right.
It's been dubbed the Valencian Spring. Not the most original of names, perhaps, but then this situation isn't unique just to Spain. In fact, it's become the latest country caught in the grip of the Eurozone crisis to see thousands upon thousands of people take to the streets to protest against the austerity measures that have been imposed upon the population. While Spain's protests have, by and large, been peaceful, there were worryingly familiar scenes last week as Spanish riot police clashed with protesters. Do you want to worry about the same thing happening here as has happened in Greece?
Yeah, I think we do worry, but we think we are just a little bit better than Greece, although Valencia, I think, is more or less the same.
Really?
Because there's no money.
Spain's not there yet. But while being a very different country with very different problems, it's now facing a scarily similar scenario to that of Greece, with the oppressed population being squeezed even tighter.
We are about 2 years behind Greece in terms of protest. But you see, the policy which the Troika, the International Monetary Fund, European Central Bank and European Union are imposing on peripheral countries, Greece, Italy, Spain, Portugal. It's economics 101. It's very simple to understand that. I mean, if these countries are with problems and you force to cut public spending, well, you push them deep into recession.
Like Greece, Spain owes billions in foreign debt, held largely by Germany and France. It's money which wouldn't be paid back were Spain to leave the Eurozone. Schools without heating, teachers without jobs, homelessness and unemployment on the rise all make for a bleak prognosis. And as the country tips into a second recession, and with more protests planned for later in the week, scenes like these could be set to become...
Let's return to the Heretics Hour, brought to you by VOR, ReasonRadioNetwork.com. And now here's Carolyn.
Welcome back once again, ladies and gentlemen. We're in our final half hour, and I am joined here with Rodney Martin telling us about the great achievements of the Third Reich, the time in Germany under Adolf Hitler. The call-in number is 1-855-477-2283. You are welcome to call in. We have a little time for that, so if you have something you want to add, something you want to say, well, just give us a call. Now, Rodney, you are going to tell us a little bit more about an assault rifle.
Yeah, this is another one kind of like Fanta soda. You know, I told everyone earlier when going down to the store and drink Fanta soda, think of the Third Reich. Well, here's another fun one. I think it's a fun one. Whenever you hear the term assault rifle, or if you have an assault rifle, if you have an AK-47, which is the Russian copycat, not as good a quality as the German one, I want you to think not only of the Third Reich, but I want you to think of Adolf Hitler for the following reasons. In about 1943, 44, the German armaments industry had developed a new rifle, automatic rifle, very proficient automatic rifle, and was presented for show and demonstration, and Adolf Hitler reviewed it, and it was presented to him as the STG-44, or it had another designation also as the MP-43 or MP-44. Now, this is a famous weapon. All people know, you know, think, and they see a picture of this weapon, and they think AK-47. It has the pistol grip, the short stock. It has a large, high-capacity, banana-looking magazine. And when Hitler saw it, looked at it, saw the uses, he says, that's an assault rifle. And we hear this all throughout history since. We hear the term assault rifle. We hear assault rifle ban because assault rifles have battlefield connotations, that there's no use for an assault rifle in hunting and things of that nature. But that term assault rifle was applied by Hitler when he was presented for review. The STG-44 became known as the Sturmgewehr. And now that weapon is a beautiful weapon. I had an opportunity to buy one not too terribly long ago, and I kicked myself for not doing it. And so proficient was that weapon. It appeared on the battlefield in 1944 during the Battle of the Bulge, and it had lethal results against, particularly in the Battle of the Bulge against the Americans. And then, of course, it drove the Soviets nuts. Or just, you know, that late in the war, there wasn't enough Germans and there wasn't enough Sturmgewehrs left. But it was deadly accurate, high capacity, and it was a heavy round. It shot the same round as the bolt action Mauser, so it was very powerful. But
okay,
a Russian by the name of Kalashnikov, I think this is important, Kevin, took that weapon and cloned it, and now the AK-47 is one of the most widely used assault rifles in the world. It is based off of Adolf Hitler's assault rifle.
Okay, all right, very good. Well, that is important to know, I think. But now let's get away from the weapons, because while they were necessary during wartime, we are talking about, and we were going to talk about the wartime weapons, but let's get back to things for the people. And, and one thing just to remind people of, that naturally the Volkswagen was also invented in Germany, designed by Adolf Hitler. And, you know, there are a lot of this whole movement to deny the National Socialist regime any of these accomplishments that were carried out during their time is so insidious, and they want to say that, oh, other people were designing that car, and the fellow Porsche really did the designing and so on. This is just not true. Naturally, he didn't engineer it, but he did design the general shape of it and said how it should go, and he's the one that put the motor in the back, and I think he was. Maybe they advised him to do that. I don't know. But he understood about aerodynamics, and then he didn't want too much wind resistance. Anyway, he was exceptionally responsible for that Volkswagen car, and then to see that it got built and it got produced and people were buying it and driving it, and then of course the Autobahn, which they also want to say, oh, that was started before his time. He just picked up on that. That was already almost done. It was an idea, but it had not. Rodney, your papers. Maybe I hear more than probably the listeners do. Okay, that it was an idea that that was starting to be talked about, but actually making it, putting it, you know, building the roads and so on, and making everything possible for it to be done, was Adolf Hitler's work, and the idea of making it beautiful, everything about Adolf Hitler, and many of the National Socialists. They never forgot about beauty. They never forgot about how the people of Germany, they wanted the people, well, certainly Hitler did, he wanted the people of Germany to appreciate and enjoy beauty and to have beauty in their lives and to have culture, to have music, to have art. And certainly with the Autobahn, he wanted them to have beautiful scenery. And so, as we've talked about before, it was built, especially in the southern part, as you get down toward Austria and into Austria, it was built just for the most impressive scenery to take advantage of the most impressive scenery, I should say. And so it was diverted wherever it needed to go. And this immensely talented engineering ability of Germans was put to work. And they put that road and bridges and so on in the most amazing places. And it's just a glorious ride through there. So that's that. And we could talk about, I could talk about some other things that aren't quite so technological. What else do you have?
Can we clarify something about this Autobahn? This goes, as you know, I have an issue about Weimar. And, you know, there has been a lot of talk. Well, the Autobahn started under Weimar. That is patently false.
Okay.
There had been some discussions about building some roads and stuff under Weimar, and that never happened. May 1st, 1933, Adolf Hitler had been chancellor on January 30th, 1933. On May 1st, 1933 was the official announcement of the German government to build the Autobahn. So that is several months after Hitler becomes chancellor. On December 15th, 1938, the opening of the 3,000th kilometer of the Autobahn had been announced. That means by 1938, they had built 3,000 kilometers of the Autobahn in 5 years.
Mm-hmm.
That's quite. Now, in the United States today, you couldn't build that much highway in 5 years. I mean, it takes that long to do the environmental impact statement, which, by the way, getting back to some of the other issues which aren't quite on line with this, but National Socialist Germany was one of the first nations to weigh environmental and health impacts when building major projects to make sure that they would not negatively impact the health of the population, but not to the degree that we do here.
Okay. Is somebody on the line with us? No? Were you typing? Somebody was typing. I didn't think you were typing and
that
talking both.
No,
I didn't think so, but somebody is. So somebody's, some line is open. All right. Well, we don't have a caller though. What is there something else you wanted to bring up?
Well, yeah, I wanted to go back, looking for my notes when you heard the papers.
yeah.
I actually dropped them on the floor, and so I was getting back. We had talked, Carolyn, previously about when people are doing their research, and this is something we talked about earlier. You know, we encourage people to do their own research, and doing their own research and thinking, that's hard work. And not just.
Well, they also can get in trouble. People can get in trouble doing research on these things, because if you just go out on the internet or even in some books, you're given a lot of bad information and false information too, which can appear to be very believable. So.
Yeah, well, when you're on the internet, you can find a lot of the scientific achievements and such. And then we talked about this previously. Then you get down and you read the comments. And I think the comments that you've seen and we've talked about are indicative of one, people being programmed, two, outright ignorance, and three, the result of years and years and years of work and books written by propagandist historians who have other motives other than true history. There is one book out that is actually really good, and it's called Hitler's Engineers, and it's written by Blaine Taylor. And it basically is just the facts. I've read this book, reviewed it. It actually has the Autobahn, the Westworld, the Volkswagen, the jets and stuff in there. And it is actually a real good book. It doesn't get into the health and some of the other issues that we talked about tonight, but it is basically, there's a very good review on Tote. There's a real good review on the scientists and such, and actually goes beyond just Werner. We know how great Werner von Braun was, but it goes before him because there were German rocket scientists in the early 30s and the early days of the Third Reich. That had been for them, there wouldn't have been a Werner von Braun. So there are some books and authors out there. I'll be posting some of them on my website as I get my website back up.
Do you want to give your website address? Do you want people to go to your website? Because I know you haven't done anything with it for quite a while.
Yeah, I've had some health issues, but you're going to see a lot of updates to it now. And I'll have some recommended readings, and one of them is the book that I just recommended. But it's www.wvfoundations.org, and I will have a section on there on recommended readings because there are some books that are just outright trash.
Okay, well, let me talk about The Nazi War on Cancer by Robert Proctor. Have you seen that? Did you look at that when you were doing your research?
I have, and that's not one that I would recommend. It has some good information. The problem is the editorialization in it outweighs the good information.
Yeah, well, if people understand that they have to, realize that you're going to have this editorializing in a lot of books, but there is good information. I understand that this book, it's not something I want to read for the same reason you just said, because of the editorializing. But I have heard that it was quite a sensation when it came out, and a lot of people were very upset because of the because of the truth it told about all the they call the Nazism's pioneering contributions in the areas of preventive medicine, environmentalism, and public health. And there's a lot about public health that we didn't get into, maybe rather than talk about this book. But this book also, here's what I want to bring up. One of the reviews, by somebody who's very anti-National Socialist, he wrote, one of his sentences was, "Nazism emerges as a kind of vast hygienic experiment that tried to create an exclusionist utopia by using both good science and laudable health drives, along with murderous practices aimed at the Jews and others deemed to be unworthy of life." Well, you know, that last part, of course, I could get upset with, but what I really don't like is saying that that it was trying to create an exclusionist utopia. Of course, they think utopia is good, and so they say call it an exclusionist one. But I don't think utopia is good. And the Third Reich was anti-utopian in the sense that it was based on the laws of nature, not on some ideology. The ideology was based on nature and natural laws. And it didn't believe in a utopia. And none of us, no racially based nationalist ideas or nation states or whatever are trying to be a utopia. They're trying to be something good for their people, their own people. That's all. Yep. And I just find this whole idea, you know, it has to do with universalism and so on, that somehow you have to let everybody in, or else you're exclusionist, which is bad. And a real utopia is when the whole world gets along together and can go anywhere and so on. This is pretty much what the opposite of National Socialist is.
Carolyn, the folks that were wanting to be the utopians or promising to be utopian were further east of Germany and Moscow. And we know that as a result of the Americans and the British siding with the communists, they provided anything but a utopia. Ask the Hungarians and the Romanians and the East Germans and such.
Yeah,
they were not utopians.
They told them they were living in utopia.
Oh, yeah.
But they knew better.
Ukrainians, Ask the 12 million Ukrainians that they starved to death in 1936, and nobody dares call it that a Holocaust. But I'm getting on a soapbox, and I won't stay on that. But let's tackle one issue of health,
okay,
and let's deal with it. Because this is one issue when we talk about National Socialist health, the boogeyman that they always bring up, and they'll talk about euthanasia and the other issue. And let's talk about that, because there was a program in National Socialist Germany, and the reason why I want to address it is because the identical a nearly identical program exists in the United States today. It was passed by the voters in Oregon. And,
well, you know, I don't care if it's in the United States, and I don't think that. Of course, maybe I think a lot of people do recognize that. That's been written about a lot. Yeah. What I'd like to say about eugenics, I'm sorry for butting in, but is that there's nothing wrong with eugenics. The opposite of eugenics is dysgenics. I mean, we should all be practicing eugenics. And the German National Socialists were.
It wasn't the eugenics that I was having an issue with. I had no problem with eugenics either. I was referencing the T4 program, and that's the one where people say that the Germans callously went along and they killed disabled and sick people unilaterally and arbitrarily and capriciously. And that is not accurate. That is not an accurate reflection of the program that was put in place that
you're
was
right.
eventually canceled under that was canceled under
yes.
Ulrich from Adolf Hitler himself.
Well,
because
it was because
abuses.
Well, yeah, there's a lot to be said about that. We don't have time to go into it. But one thing we can make very clear is that it's the difference between eugenics and euthanasia. And people do get that all mixed up. Euthanasia was one thing that had a short life in Germany, and I think it can be defended. But not everybody does. But that's, you know, my different idea. But eugenics is totally innocent and totally good.
Yeah.
And it's been given a bad name because it's been associated with the Third Reich, but also with certain abuses, maybe enforcing sterilizing people without informing them that they're going to be sterilized, things like that, which was done in the United States. It was not done in Nazi Germany.
Carolyn, it's been given a bad name because of Marxist political correctness instead of science. There are scientific and public health reasons as to why there should be eugenics, and that's an absolute fact. There are doctors, I know, well-respected doctors, that will tell you there should be eugenics, but they'll tell you that in the privacy of a room with, you know, between cigars and drinks. They won't tell you that, you know, publicly because they'll probably be disbarred for all intents and purposes. But what I was getting at is you're absolutely right. There is an absolute difference between eugenics and the euthanasia and the propagandist historians try to muddle the two up and make it into some sort of diabolical process, but it absolutely was not. They were both based in medical science. They were based in sound policies and procedures, and the one was canceled ultimately. And, if the euthanasia program had been carried out the way it was originally mandated and the way that, Oregon carries theirs out to this day, there wouldn't be anything wrong with it, and there isn't anything wrong with it. And the problem is like I said earlier, is getting people to do research and think for themselves based on facts and not fiction, and instead of peer pressure and afraid of being called names. That's hard work.
Well, people have been taught that every time you go into anything where doctors or medical people are in charge of making decisions, that it's going to be abused, and then they're given, like you say, propaganda about how it was abused by the National Socialists, or they call them the Nazis. But actually, most of the abuse of this stuff took place amongst American medical personnel and so on, in all the non-white peoples that they were experimenting on. Talk about experimenting on people. They experimented on people. They experiment even today on people in prison. They experiment on people who are helpless in sanatoriums and so on, in different ways. But it's all political.
There were far more ordinances and codes and safeguards to protect the people we're talking about in their National Socialist Germany than there are then and now in the convoluted jurisdictional hodgepodge that is the United States.
Oh, sure.
That's a fact.
It is. One of these days, I want to do a program on eugenics and the Lebensborn. I don't know if it's pronounced Lebensborn or Lebensborn.
Lebensborn.
Program.
Lebensborn. Yeah.
Leben, that's right, Lebensborn program.
You know,
it's so interesting, you know. It's really interesting.
You know, the celebrities that people have seen on TV for years that are Lebensborn babies, that people wouldn't realize that they just have to go and do a little bit of research. But Judy Robinson on Lost in Space was a Lebensborn baby.
Well, the thing is, it was a very positive, good program. There was nothing wrong with it.
Mm-hmm.
And even Wikipedia, let's see if I can find that. On Wikipedia now, they even say, because I looked there, they admit that, where is that part? That there was nothing wrong with it, and that it was given a bad name for,
Carolyn, this does fall into public health.
Oh, here it is. Here it is. Let me just say this. During the war, Lebensborn was also, at the Nuremberg trials, no evidence was found of direct involvement by the Lebensborn organization. Now that's something different than the kidnapping. But, I never can find what I'm looking for when I'm looking for it. But anyway, even on Wikipedia, as I said, they admit that the things that were said about it were said right after the war, right at the end of the war, in order to criminalize even more the SS.
Carolyn, I would say that the this falls within public health as well, the care of children and having a safe and healthy environment. I would submit that the Lebensborn's homes for the mothers and for the children were far more healthy and nurturing than a lot of the orphanages in the United States and in Britain and France and other so-called Western nations at the time, because that government took a role that the folk mattered, that they weren't castaways, and they were concerned about the tremendous decline in birth rates that had taken place in Weimar, because Weimar had imported foreign decadent values, and the German birth rate, one, had taken a tremendous hit as a result of this thing called World War One, and two, people were told, oh, don't have babies, just go out and do your own thing. So Weimar didn't help matters any. And so between 1933 and 1935-36, you had a 500,000 new babies born under the new National Socialist government.
That's right.
And this was right at the precursor. So, I mean,
I found my quote here. This is from Wikipedia. After World War II, it was reported that Lebensborn was a breeding program. Individuals were not forced to have sex with selected partners, as the propaganda goes. The program was restricted to medical selections that applied eugenic and race criteria. Well, that is that, women who had been married SS men or had been impregnated by an SS man and they were not married and wanted to have their child, they had these places where they could go, and in the Lebensborn program you had to be you had to meet certain criteria. It's true.
Mm-hmm.
This was the eugenics at work. This was the kind of people that they were encouraging, the kind of births and so on that they were encouraging to build a stronger Germany. And because the German gene pool had gotten kind of messed up during, like you say, during Weimar.
And before we run out of time, there's been some attempts recently of late to smear that program to say that it was a breeding ground for child sex. And that is absolutely incorrect. They were not taking 12 and 13-year-old German girls in there to have sex with SS adults. They had strict rules and requirements. And, at some point, maybe we can talk about law and order in Nazi Germany, because people that preyed on children were tended to correctly, unlike they are here in this country.
Yes, and so anybody who's reading about that, who reads that stuff, you should just dismiss it because it's not true. And the mothers and children at these places got very good treatment. In fact, maybe they got some people who weren't there were jealous, and that's part of why they they were mistreated later because they were jealous that they got such good treatment when those who were not in these homes didn't get such good treatment. So,
heaven forbid that we'll take care of women and children in need. I mean, heaven forbid.
And heaven forbid that we want to have the very best, most intelligent, most healthy, you know, best looking people on this planet. Heaven forbid that we should want that.
Well, you know, that's a different.
All right, Rodney, we have to stop. I want to say goodbye to you properly. Good night, Rodney Martin, my guest.
Thanks for listening. The Heretics Hour returns Monday evening, 9 p.m. Eastern U.S. time. Join us at ReasonRadioNetwork.com.